The following is a presentation of VBR. Welcome, and thank you for joining us in our study of God's Holy Word.
This is video number 19 of the video Bible reading of the book of Acts. We're continuing in Acts chapter 7. We left off in verse 22, which is in the midst of Stephen, one of the seven who had been appointed to take care of the needs of the widows and others waiting tables for the church in the city of Jerusalem in the early days. And Stephen had been accused after having done signs and wonders and preaching the gospel of Jesus very effectively in at least one and maybe several of the synagogues in Jerusalem. He had been accused of speaking against the temple, the holy place, and against the law of Moses, and accused of saying that Jesus would tear down the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. And those were, of course, distortions, but when Stephen was brought to trial before the Sanhedrin, rather than defending himself, he defended the gospel. He made a case for the fact that a holy place is the place where God is. And it's his message in Acts chapter 7 stresses the idea that God never was interested in having a single place where he would be worshiped, that a temple never was his solution to the needs of mankind for approaching him. And in those first 22 verses, Stephen, first of all, in verses 2 through 16, drew from the book of Genesis, Genesis chapters 11 through 50, where we have the account of God calling Abraham and bringing him into Canaan, and then Abraham's children, Isaac, and Isaac's son Jacob, and the 12 patriarchs that were born of Jacob. That story is reviewed in verses 2 through 16, the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their progeny, and how they worshiped in various places in the land of Canaan, as well as Abraham being a follower of God before he even came into Canaan, as well as the fact that the family went and resided in Egypt. And then in verses 20 through 22, Stephen draws on the book of Exodus, and particularly with the birth of Moses, Exodus chapter 2 and verses 1 through 10, giving an overview of the early life of Moses. As we come today to verse 23, Acts chapter 7, verses 23 through 29, I'm going to read those verses from the English Standard Version. And the he in this verse is Moses, when he was 40 years old. Acts chapter 7, verses 23 through 29. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them being wrong, he offended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. And on the following day, he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, your brothers, why do you wrong each other?" But the man who was wronging his neighbor thrust him aside, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" At this retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. Now, this portion of the story that Stephen is rehearsing before the Sanhedrin was familiar to all of them, of course, and it comes from Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 through 25, a little overview of what we're told about Moses there. When Stephen says that Moses was 40 years old at this time, that's not actually in the Hebrew text. It says that when he was grown, he went out among his people there, came into his heart to visit his brothers. But Stephen was aware of Jewish traditions and oral information that was available there, and very likely a source that has been destroyed since those early days after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. This was probably a fact that was known not only to Stephen, but to the others in the Sanhedrin, that Moses was 40 years old when this transition came into his life. It came into his heart to visit his brothers. Now, among the other things that Stephen is doing here in this defense, it's a defense of the gospel of Christ. And this is the prophetic idea of the incarnation, that Jesus fulfilling the prophecies that were associated with one like Moses, Jesus came to his own, and his own did not receive him. That's in John chapter 1, verse 11. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. That's the wording in the New American Standard Bible. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. This is echoing what Stephen said here in front of the Sanhedrin, that Moses came to visit his brothers, but his brothers did not accept him, did not receive him. He supposed his brothers would understand that God was giving him salvation by his hand. But Moses was misunderstood, and he was rejected. He attempted to bring reconciliation, but the people did not listen to him at that time. He was rejected. He was specifically rejected by the man who was wronging his neighbor. And again, Stephen here is drawing connections. It's almost like he's using a parable to draw connections to what had happened to Jesus when Jesus came to his own and was rejected. And it was those who were not following God, no matter what their reputation might be. He was rejected specifically by people who were wronging their neighbors. This is the sort of assessment that both John the Baptist and Jesus gave of the religious leaders of their generation, a generation of vipers, people taking advantage of other people. So Stephen, again, is drawing parallels that are fulfilled in Jesus. And whereas it says that Moses thought that his brethren would understand, and they did not, of Jesus, John, in John chapter 2:25, says Jesus didn't need anyone to tell him what was in the hearts of men, because he knew what was in the hearts of men. He was not surprised. And Mark 8:31, Jesus taught his disciples. Mark 8:31 from the NIV, Jesus began to teach them, his disciples, that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. The very people that Stephen is standing in front of at this time. That he must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days rise again. So Jesus understood that he was going to be rejected. Moses didn't realize that initially when he was a younger man and first tried to step up and help his people. But they, much to his surprise, did not conform to his ideas of good behavior and see that they needed a man like him to redeem them, reconcile them, and bring them to freedom. Once again, Stephen here reiterates from Exodus chapter 2, verses 15 through 22, the fact that Moses left Egypt and went to Midian. And so the scene is not in Canaan, not in the Promised Land. It's certainly not in Jerusalem, not in the temple. Remember that the household that Moses joined in Midian, his father-in-law is referred to as being a priest in Midian. So there are people worshiping God, because the indication is that Jethro knew the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there are people who are not in Israel, not in the land, not in Jerusalem, not even Israelites per se, descendants of Lot, who at that time, in the days of Moses, still knew who God was and were worshipers of God, not in the confines of the temple. Acts chapter 7, verses 30 through 34, reading on in the English Standard Version, Stephen continues saying, when 40 years had passed, so if Moses was 40 when he left Egypt, 40 years later, he's now 80 years old. And that is in the text regarding the time when Moses was called by God in the Old Testament. Now, when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him, to Moses, in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in a flame of fire in a bush. When Moses saw it, he was amazed at the sight, and he drew near to look. There came the voice of the Lord. I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And Moses trembled and did not dare to look. Then the Lord said to him, take off the sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and they have heard their groaning. And I have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. Now, what Stephen briefly summarizes there is the dialogue, the interaction between God and Moses that we have in Exodus chapters 3 and 4, where God is urging Moses to go to Egypt and lead his people out with mighty signs and wonders. In verse 30 here, in Acts 7:30, we have the idea of the 40 years of Moses in Egypt, the 40 years in Midian, and then the angel of the Lord spoke to him when he was 80 years old. An angel appeared to him in the burning bush at Sinai. This angel And Stephen is using language consistent with the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament that was widely used in those days. This angel is referred to as the angel of the Lord in most English Bibles in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 2. We shouldn't take that the word the there to indicate that this is a unique or a special angel, because this very same language is used many times in reference to angelic appearances in both the Old and the New Testaments. He was, as Stephen says here, an angel. An angel appeared to Moses in the bush. The angelic voice that spoke to Moses is identified in Exodus and also by Stephen here as the voice of the Lord. Now, we use language like that all the time. I've never been in the physical presence of the singers, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and yet I've heard them sing many times because I heard it through the medium of radio broadcast, of recordings of various kinds, videos, DVDs, and so forth. I've heard them sing many times. I can say I've heard Peter, Paul, and Mary, even though I've never been actually in their presence. Similarly, I've never seen with my own eyes in physical proximity a president of the United States. And yet, in my lifetime, I have seen numerous presidents of the United States in terms of photographs, in terms of television, video, various kinds of presentations. We see and hear people through various media all the time and speak of having seen what we saw through the medium as having seen the real thing. The various media, the pictures, the images, the recordings, the radio, the TV, the internet, all of these are genuine experiences of what people have said and done, the actual seeing and the actual hearing. So in similar descriptive language, at the burning bush and many other times, the medium through which God appeared and through which God spoke was an angel. As we also have here in Acts, when an angel of the Lord released the apostles from jail and gave them instructions to go to the temple and continue proclaiming the gospel in Acts chapter 5, verse 19. We had that a few videos ago. Stephen here and the writer of Hebrews later strongly emphasize the contrast between the law that was given through the medium of angels and the new covenant, which was given very directly by the Son of God who became a man and dwelt among us in person. Very strong emphasis on the uniqueness of what Jesus accomplished by coming into human history as a human being, God in the flesh. Here in Acts chapter 7 and verse 32, God says to Moses, as Stephen recounts, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." One God when Abraham is in Mesopotamia, when Abraham is in Paddan Aram, when Abraham is in Shechem, when Abraham is in Canaan, when Jacob is in Egypt, when Moses is in Midian, when Moses and Israel are Sinai, it's all the same God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when God related that to Moses in Exodus 3:15, he used that expression, "I am, tell them I am has sent you." And then he goes on and says, "I am who I am," and he identifies himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Exodus 3:15. He says, "This is my name forever." He is a God of history. He is a God who has dealt with human beings in the past, as he deals with us in the present, in real space, real time, real history. "This is my name forever, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." This is the God that Stephen is proclaiming through the person and work of Jesus Christ. So Israel was in Egypt in this segment that Stephen is relating. Israel was in Egypt, and Moses was in the wilderness of Sinai. The place where Moses stood was holy ground, Stephen says. That's what the text says in Exodus. Why was it holy ground? Well, because God spoke to him there. Where the Lord is, this is holy ground, where God's presence is. It's not because of any man-made structure. There was no temple there. There was no man-made structure that we have any awareness of at all. But because of the presence of God, because God manifested himself through that angel in the bush, this is holy ground. And Stephen is being accused, remember, of speaking against the holy place, meaning the temple in Jerusalem. So he's making the case that wherever God is, God makes that place holy. God's presence made that place holy. The presence of the Lord makes any place holy, not just temples. In Psalm 68, which has a number of messianic prophecies woven into it, Psalm 68 and verse 17 makes the statement that Sinai is now in the sanctuary. And that's referring to the fact that God's glory was revealed at Sinai, And then when they built the tabernacle, the glory of God came into the tabernacle. The tabernacle in Exodus chapter 40, when they consecrated it, God's glory filled that tabernacle. Later, that tabernacle was moved around various places. But finally, the Ark of the Covenant came to rest in Jerusalem. And when Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem and they moved the Ark of the Covenant into the now sanctified temple, once again, the glory of God filled that structure. The Sinai, the glory of God that was there at Sinai, the glory that dealt with Moses at Sinai, had come into the sanctuary, which moved through the wilderness and finally came to rest, the Ark of the Covenant and the bronze altar and so forth, finally came to rest in Jerusalem. But the holy ground idea was not limited to what happened with Solomon and afterward in Jerusalem. And when God said to Moses, take off your sandals, the priestly regalia that we have described in the 28th and 29th chapters of the book of Exodus, the garments of the high priest and the regular priest, that priestly regalia included robes, included headgear, included undergarments. The one thing it did not include was shoes. There were no shoes, no sandals included in the priestly regalia. Whenever the priests would serve in the temple itself, whenever they are around the altar and they're going to be washing their hands and feet on a regular basis many times during the day, they're not wearing shoes. Why? Well, the place they're standing is holy ground. And so they are barefoot in their service of God. The priest, including the high priest who sat in this council, when they are serving in the priestly office in the temple, are like Moses at Mount Sinai. They're barefoot on holy ground, hundreds of miles from Mount Sinai, because God is manifested there. He has chosen that as a place. But it doesn't have to be that place. It could be Joshua standing at Gilgal on the eve of going into Jericho in the fifth chapter of the book of Joshua. And Joshua is told by the commander of the army of the Lord to take off his shoes. He was on holy ground. It can be Moses at Sinai. It can be the priests in the temple. The location is not the point. The presence of God is the point that Stephen is stressing here for them to apprehend. And God says to Moses, as Stephen relates here in verse 34, I have come down to deliver them. God has come down to deliver his people out of Egypt. This is what Stephen was claiming had happened in the person of Jesus. God had come down to deliver his people, to deliver people from sin. The Lord had come down to deliver his people from their afflictions. Stephen knew the circumstances related by God about Egypt and the suffering that was going on there. God knew the circumstances of his people. He came to the rescue. Jesus came to the rescue. God knew the circumstances of his people, and Jesus had come down to deliver them, just as God, the language that God used in speaking to Moses. Acts chapter 7, verses 35 through 41. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge? This man God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, God will raise up for me, for you, a prophet like me from among your brothers. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us. Our fathers refused to obey him, but thrust him aside, and in their hearts they turned to Egypt, saying to Aaron, make for us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And they made a calf in those days and ordered a sacrifice to the idol and were rejoicing in the works of their hands. Now that's from Exodus chapters 5 through 32. It's a summary of the entirety of the account of the plagues and the Exodus and going to Mount Sinai and Moses being on the mountain and culminating with the golden calf incident in Exodus chapter 32. And here in verse 35, God chose Moses. The people rejected him, but God chose Moses. And again, Stephen is weaving this picture, this parable of sorts from the history of the past. God chose Jesus. We've had that language already in the sermons, the speeches that were given by Peter. God chose Jesus, but the people rejected him. It's the same story all over again, only with greater consequences this time than that. God chose Moses and the people rejected him. So we're returning to the theme from verses 24 through 28, when Moses was 40 years old and went out among the people, and they rejected him. But this time, God has actually chosen him and sent him. It isn't just Moses acting on his own. And so it highlights again that rejecting the divine deliverer, as they had with Jesus, had happened before. It has happened again in recent history with Jesus. This man, Stephen says, God sent, and the man he's referring to is Moses, but he's also alluding to Jesus. This man, God has sent as both ruler and redeemer. Two different roles in one individual, which is the case with the Christ. He is ruler and he is redeemer. We owe him our obedience and we owe him our gratitude. He is ruler, he is redeemer. One man sent by God, both ruler and redeemer, even though rejected by the people. He's chosen by God and he's ruler whether people accept him or not. And he is redeemer whether people accept him or not. One man fulfilling these functions, and that man was Moses in his day, but that is Jesus in the days when Stephen was prophet, was proclaiming here and still to this day. And again, Stephen stressed, Moses was sent by the hand of the angel who appeared in the bush. It was an angel who told Moses what to do, whereas Jesus spoke directly with the authority of God. But Moses was sent by the hand of the angel. Tremendous and authoritative, but not as great a thing as what had happened in their own lifetimes, their own experience, what they had seen with their own eyes. Verse 36, this man, Moses, this man led them out, performing wonders and signs. And everyone in that room, this assembly of the Sanhedrin, everyone in that room knew about the signs and wonders that Jesus had done. Several of the people in that room had walked by the cross of Jesus saying, he saved others, let's see if he can save himself. He trusted God, let's see if God now saves him. People in that room had sat there when Peter and John had sat there some months before after the healing of the lame man in the precincts of the temple, and they had said among themselves, we can't deny that a miracle has taken place. Now what do we do about it? These same people had sat there in fury when all of the apostles were on trial in the fifth chapter of Acts, and most of them had wanted to put them to death until Gamaliel spoke up with a word of wisdom and said, let's show some restraint. Let's have some patience. Let's wait and see what happens here. But they knew about the signs and wonders, and no one was denying that Jesus had genuinely done signs and wonders. Even if you read in the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud that was composed from the 4th through the 5th or 6th centuries, the Babylonian Talmud, and if you read in the Jewish literature of the rabbis, they don't deny that Jesus did signs and wonders. They ascribe them to magic. They ascribe them to sorcery, but they don't deny that he did signs and wonders, even in the literature of the rabbis. And so here are these folks, and when Stephen says that Moses had done signs and wonders to give him credibility among the people, they knew very well that Jesus had, the apostles had, and Stephen himself had been doing signs and wonders. That's what caused him to be arrested. Because of the signs and wonders and the wisdom by which he spoke, they had raised up these false witnesses and brought him to trial. So this was something that would have resonated with them when Stephen made reference to the signs and wonders, those that they were very much aware of in their own very recent past and still going on right then in the name of Jesus in the city of Jerusalem. So Stephen is telling them and telling us through the record that we have here, a new exodus has occurred. Passover has been fulfilled. Passover lamb has been sacrificed, a new exodus has occurred, and there is a new deliverance from bondage. This time it isn't bondage in Egypt, it's bondage to the ruler of this world, bondage in sin, the bondage to sin and death. Moses had said, as Stephen mentions here in verse 37, a prophet like me will be raised up by God. And Stephen, like Peter before him back in the third chapter of Acts that we had a few weeks ago, Stephen, like Peter before him, is saying that has been fulfilled. God has raised up a prophet like Moses, one who is a deliverer, one who is both a ruler and a redeemer, has been raised up by God. A prophet like me, that prophet had come, and they all knew it. They didn't all like it. They didn't want to accept it, but they knew the truth of what Stephen was talking about. The apostles who had stood in that same assembly were men who had done signs and wonders. Stephen was on trial in part because he had been doing signs and wonders in the name of Jesus. Remember what Peter's message was after healing the lame man. from the very scriptures that Stephen is alluding to here, that these things that Moses had prophesied about a prophet like him being raised up, God raised up Jesus. They knew this message. This is not a new message to these people. They could not escape hearing that message. In verse 38, Stephen refers to the congregation in the wilderness, the assembly of people in the wilderness. We have Moses, we have the angel who spoke to him, we have the congregation of Israel. All of this is at Sinai, wandering in the wilderness, and none of this is at Jerusalem. Again, this is part of what he's accused of, that he's speaking against the holy place. And he's saying, that was a holy place, Sinai, the angel, Moses, the congregation, all of that, that was a holy place because of what God did there at that time. This is the second time that the word congregation has come up in Acts. It's the word ecclesia, which very often in the New Testament is translated in English translations with the word church. It means an assembly or a congregation. It was in Acts chapter 5:11, great fear seized the whole church, the whole congregation, all of those believers in Jesus who were gathered in Jerusalem. Most of the time in the New Testament, that's how it is used. It's used to describe the Christians who followed Jesus. But it's an ordinary word, and it can describe any group or any gathering or any assembly. And the congregation in the desert, I don't doubt that Stephen had a little bit of a double meaning and tension when he used that expression, because the people of God are the congregation, not the temple. And we sometimes have that same issue today with the word church. The people confused a location, a structure, a building, with the idea of the church. But the church is the assembly, the congregation of God's people. And that's where God's presence is. It isn't in an empty building. It's in the people of God who come together in his name, in the authority by the name of Jesus. Stephen says here that Moses received and gave to the people living oracles, the living word of God, not the structure of the temple, not even the rituals. Those things, the instructions for ritual and the instructions for building the tabernacle were a part of the law, but the living oracles, the living message from God, something that transcends time, place, and generations, the living revelation of God's word. And of course, that is finally and fully personified in Jesus. He is the living oracle, the living revelation of God. In their hearts, our fathers turned back to Egypt. And that's what this is all about, is where the heart is. In their hearts, our fathers turned back to Egypt. That's where God is either enthroned or not, is in the heart of humanity, the hearts of mankind, not in physical structures. And they made and worshiped a golden calf, worshiping the images, the things made by their own hands. They made and worshiped a golden calf. And Stephen is correlating the golden calf then with the golden temple that Herod had started and was still under construction even to that day. 46 years in building is mentioned in the second chapter of John. They had confused the structure of the temple with the sacredness of God. And as the Israelites in the wilderness had confused the golden calf with the God who led them out of Egypt. They rejected Moses, whom God had chosen. They rejoiced in the works of their own hands. And these folks were also rejoicing in the works of their own hands, in the structure of that temple, which was so magnificent. The temple, the state that Stephen was accused of blaspheming, had become like the golden calf. They were rejoicing in the works of their own hands. And this is a conflict about what the temple truly is, what the location is of God's presence, what holy ground truly is. And we're going to pause here again, not done with Stephen's message yet, but we're going to pause here again and pick up next time in Acts chapter 7 and verse 42.